Think about how ancient idolatry looks to us. You can visit ruins or look at photographs of statues that were used in ancient idolatry, where people would bow before those statues and perform rituals and do things to honor this representation of some god. It was so commonplace among the great civilizations of ancient history. The Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Greeks and the Romans, all of them were idolatry was commonplace. But most modern people view that activity as at least superstitious. And at the most, even silly and ridiculous. We think that we're beyond that and we're so sophisticated that we wouldn't act that way in front of a piece of marble or wood. But then how do you explain people's reaction to Justin Bieber and Brad Pitt and a couple of decades ago Michael Jackson, and a decade before him the Beatles, and a decade before him Elvis Presley, and a decade before him, I'm going beyond you now, Frank Sinatra, who was a heartthrob in the late 30s, early 40s, and before him, the decade before him, who was the first real media sensation when people laid eyes on him, Rudolph Valentino, the swarthy silent film actor that when his movie, The Sheik, premiered, women passed out in the aisles in the theater. Now who's silly? Who's got the corner on the market of, out of admiration, acting ridiculous? Well, there are a couple of facts I want you to see as we start this morning. One is humans have this innate craving to admire someone and to look up to someone greater than themselves and to express worship. The problem is that we humans, this craving that we have, the way we most of the time try to answer that craving is off the mark. Whether it be the Egyptians worshiping Ra or the Greeks worshiping Diana or some screaming teenager swooning before a pop star, we have a twisted view of adoration and admiration and praise. We were made and designed to worship. We humans need to worship. But oftentimes we're amiss in how we do it, and we need help in directing ourselves to first the object of our worship and also the way we should worship. Well, this morning we continue our series of lessons centering around this theme that we have for 2012, and that is our God, our worship, our assembly. And the reason why we're doing this year, not only in some sermons, the sermons here in January and February and once a month after that, and the some things we're doing in our service is to, first of all, to focus more on God and to see God more clearly and to bring to Him a greater devotion of worship and to appreciate more the fact that we're called to be a body of worshipers and to value the time that has been commanded of us to come together and to worship collectively, to see God, to bring to Him the worship that honors Him, and to appreciate our role in the congregation of worshipers. And we've been looking the last few weeks at some lessons to help us focus on God and to seek God and to see God and to know God and to draw closer to Him. And this morning we turn our attention to the subject of worship, which is a natural subject after spending some time studying about looking at God and drawing closer to Him, because that is the natural reaction to seeing God. And this morning we want to look at a subject simply called defining worship. And it's a very important lesson. It's more of a teaching lesson than preaching lesson. And it's really important in that it provides scaffolding, just like scaffolding around a building that's being constructed, that the scaffolding is erected so that the workers can work and do the work that needs to be done as the project progresses. Well, in a way, this lesson is a scaffolding lesson. That some things that we will put in place in this lesson, some teaching that we will lay out, some scriptures that we'll examine, will help us to do some of the things we'll do later on in this coming month in February on worship and the assembly, as well as in the coming months when we study about things like singing and the Lord's Supper and praying and these kinds of things. And so look with me in a lot of scriptures this morning, and we'll look at, really most of them will be on the screen, so that we can have a purely scriptural view of worship and to deepen our understanding of it. Well, first thing we want to do is start with some definitions of even the words that are used in the Bible. We start with the common word in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Old Testament, for worship. We see this example in Exodus chapter 4, verse 31. So the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, this is when Moses comes, you know, with the message that he's going to lead them to deliverance, and that he had looked on their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshiped. Note how oftentimes in Bible examples of worship, not always, but sometimes there is some description of the physical posture or action of the person that indicates the mood and the mindset of the person. This is a Greek word that is commonly found in the Old Testament for worship, shekah. And it literally means to bow down. And it's a word that is not just found in worship to God, but it's also a word that sometimes is used to describe a person bowing to another person. Most commonly, like in the Old Testament, it would be someone of high stature, like a king, some kind of ruler. But it is especially used of bowing before God, and thus you see the example here in Exodus chapter 4. But in the New Testament, it's interesting. There are several Greek words that we have translated in our English Bibles as worship, but it's important to note the distinction. You may have studied at one time or another how the Greeks had different words for love. There's the agape love, the unselfish love. There's a phileo love, the love of brotherly relationship and kindness. Okay? And you see those loves used in the New Testament? So it is with worship in the New Testament. For instance, in Revelation, the scene there, worship of God in heaven. And all the angels stood around the throne and the elders and the four living creatures and fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God. This is the word in the Greek, proskuneo. And it literally means to kiss toward. In ancient times, a kiss was not just an action of affection. It was an action of reverence and respect. Thus, you know, you see the tradition, you know, of kissing the king's ring or the king's hand. You've heard of that, you know, and see that maybe in a movie or read about it in a book. And it's an ancient practice. The kiss toward was an act of respect and reverence toward. And so, proskuneo meant to kiss toward and to do reverence, to show reverence toward one. And so you see this word proskuneo used all through the New Testament to bow before someone. And sometimes it's used to describe bowing before someone who's a human being, not God. Again, like a ruler. But it's the most common expression in the New Testament for worship to God. And really, most of the times that you find this word in the New Testament, it's talking about worshiping God, showing reverence to God, bowing down before God. There's some other words used, like in Acts chapter 18, talks about this man here. He departed from there and entered the house of a certain man named Justus, one who worshipped God, whose house was next door to the synagogue. This is the Greek term serbomai. It means to show reverence and show devotion. And so instead of this mental picture of the kiss and the reverence, it means it's a general heart. Not so much an act, but a general heart and attitude and life of devotion to someone. And it's used in reference to God, not that common. You see it occasionally in reference to God. Proskuneo is more common, and then this one is common. In Acts chapter 24, Paul is making his defense of preaching the gospel and being a Christian, and he says, "But this I confess to you, that which according to the way, which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets." Paul said he was a Christian, he obeyed the gospel, he was walking in the way of Christ, and this is how he was even being true to the faith of his ancestors, the Hebrews, in that he was worshiping God according to the way of Jesus Christ. This is an interesting word. It's latro. And it means literally to serve. And that's why, and we'll note some of these later this morning, in English Bible, sometimes it's translated worship. Sometimes it's translated service. Now, they overlap. The one you worship is the one you serve. But in its, you know, root sense, it's the concept of giving service to someone. And it's used not just in serving God, but in serving, you know, a servant serving his master, or a neighbor serving a friend, or something like that. But here, as you can see, it's used in reference to Paul's way of life. Not just some one-time expression of worship, but his way of life in serving God. And so that's why it's rendered here worship. And then there's this English word that we use, worship. It's a word that cropped up a long way in among people who spoke English. And you can see sort of the concept of worthiness in the word worship. It's what you do before someone that you consider worthy. Somebody that is full of worthiness. Somebody that is elevated before you. It's how you treat one worthy of respect and honor. And that's the background to that English word. But our English Bibles are pulling from all these different words when it translates these passages with the word worship. Well, think about this with me. First of all, we just see the one, you know, concept here that's consistent through all these examples. And that is, worship means giving honor. It means showing respect. And in a technical sense, in a truly technical sense, even these words used by the Hebrews and the Greeks, it's possible to worship parents in the sense that you give them honor. Or a judge or a ruler or a supervisor at work in the sense that you show them respect in that very, you know, limited way. And so these same Bible words were used to describe an action of a human toward another human that you're showing respect. And in those cases, it's never condemned. It's a legitimate use. But there is a special sense in which these terms were applied to God. And everybody understood that. Everybody understood the difference between showing respect to your parents or to the prince, and showing reverence and respect to God. And there's a couple of passages that indicate this. First, in the Old Testament, where Psalm 29 says, "Give unto the Lord the glory due to His name. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness." That there is a glory that is due God, that is uniquely God's. It belongs to Him. When Jesus was tempted by the devil to worship Him, Jesus responded, "Away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and Him only you shall serve." Well, there's a way in which you can show respect to human beings. But when it comes to what Satan was trying to get Jesus to do here, this had to do with bowing down and revering and respecting to the highest degree. And Jesus says, it's only God that we're to worship. So there's a common respect we can show an older person, we can show a teacher, we can show a police officer, and it's a good idea to do that if you're pulled over. Okay? But there is a degree of respect and a type of honor that is due God that is not due any other person, living creature, being, or thing. And so there is this way of worship and type and depth of worship that only belongs to God. And it's important that we live with that every day. We would do well to make sure that there is a distinction in our thinking, in our speech, and in our behavior regarding this. We may be impressed with someone because they can They have this incredible ability to play the piano or paint a painting or to throw a football. And we may admire somebody for their courage and their kindness and their wisdom. But when we view God, there should be a depth and a breadth of admiration that we experience. And there should be a praise that we give Him that's unlike any other. God is to be holy to us, set apart. That in our minds and hearts, our speech, and even our behavior, that we elevate Him to a level where there's no one else. He alone, the Lord, is God. And that's the terms that are used. And when these terms are employed, I want you to consider with me this morning that there are three dimensions to this. And this is really important. And again, this is scaffolding. This is going to serve us in the months ahead as we explore the subject of God and worship and our assemblies even more. I want you to consider with me that when you begin to look at worship in the Bible, that there are three different dimensions or aspects of worship. First of all, there's worship as a way of life. And there's just several passages about this, especially in the New Testament. For instance, Paul. He says in Romans 12, "Therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship." Except, unless it's noted, all the passages appear from the New King James, but this one is from the New American Standard. And look what Paul is describing here for us. He's talking, he's pulling from the Old Testament an imagery, isn't he? And that is of the Old Testament worshipers coming and bringing animal sacrifices. But here he says, you're to present to God your bodies a living sacrifice. And that is, as it says here in the New American, your spiritual service of worship. This is the Greek word latro. The word latro that means to serve. Which sometimes is translated in our English Bibles, worship or service. The New International says your spiritual acts of worship. The English Standard Version, which is an excellent version, by the way. Your spiritual worship. The New Century Version says the spiritual way for you to worship. All these translators understand something. That this term used here, though it has this connotation of service, it has undergirding it the idea of worship. This is how you worship God, by the service that you render to Him. And look what it says. This Old Testament terminology reminds us of dead animals, dead lambs, dead bulls, dead goats. They would slaughter these animals and lay them on the altar and burn them in honor to God. But as Christians, things are different now. We present to God a sacrifice. Something that costs us something. An unselfish gift to God. It's a living sacrifice. It's our bodies. It's the life and the breath and the flesh that God has given to us that we use in a life of service to Him. And in that way, that's worship. Look at the next verse in the New American Standard, verse 2. "And do not be conformed to this world." This is part of this. You're to present your bodies a living sacrifice, and here's the opposite. You're not to be conformed to the world. Because that's not going to be presenting your body as a living sacrifice and worship to God. But be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. And he's going to talk in the rest of this chapter here about specific things you do in your life and actions you take to live for Christ as a living sacrifice. It starts in renewing your mind that I'm not going to be like the world. I'm going to be Christ. And I'm going to do the will of God. And I'm going to do what is perfect and good and complete and proper. That is how you lay yourself upon the altar and present to God a living sacrifice, which is your service, which is how you worship Him. Look at these statements in Hebrews 13. Again, pulling from the Old Testament worship. "Therefore, by Him," speaking of Christ, "let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God." That is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to His name. But do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. The way we bring our worship to God in these texts is that we live a life of service. And to God, it's reminiscent of a sacrifice, like they had animal sacrifices in the Old Testament. But it's not just some ritual. It's not just even some one-time act. It's a way of life. Worship involves a life of righteousness, a life of service to God through Christ to honor Him. You see how broad it is, can't you? The concept of worship. But it's more than just a lifestyle. It involves expression. Because we see so many passages that describe worship as a private expression. I want you to look with me at three examples of this. And there's so many. One in the Old Testament, two in the New. In the Old Testament, we have Abraham sending his servant in Genesis 24 to fetch for him a wife for his son Isaac. He didn't want Isaac to marry some Canaanite. He wanted Isaac to marry somebody from the family back in Haran. And he just says, go and fetch somebody from the family. And the servant's like, this is going to be hard. How am I going to find this girl? He said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, please give me success this day and show me kindness to my master Abraham. He's praying for God to help him. So he takes his trip and goes all the way from Canaan up to Haran. And lo and behold, the girl that he runs into is from Abraham's wife's family, Sarah's family. And he is just overwhelmed. And he walks right up and he finds the girl. Okay? Finds the one, so to speak. Then the man bowed down his head and worshiped the Lord. And he said, blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth toward my master. As for me being on the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren. Right then and right there, when that man realized what God had done for him, what God had done for Abraham and Abraham's family, he stopped and he worshiped God. He expressed his worship privately between him and God. But this is something you see in the New Testament. In John 9, we read about Jesus healing the man who was blind from birth, who's persecuted because he testified that Jesus had done this because he did it on the Sabbath and it disturbed the religious leaders. Jesus heard they cast him out, John 9. And when he found him, he said to him, do you believe in the Son of God? He answered and said, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have both seen him, and it's he who is talking with you. And he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. It's Jesus and this man. This is the Greek term proskuneo, which means to bow down. Whether it's in his heart or with his heart and his body, he bows before Jesus. This is one of the impressive things you see, especially in the Gospel of John, of people giving worship to Jesus. Instead of like Peter or John, or the angel, even in the book of Revelation, saying, oh no, don't bow before us, we're not God. Jesus accepts the worship. Because he is God the Son. And this man here, this man healed of his blindness, he privately and personally expressed his worship to God. And then look at this text. James chapter 5. I skipped it there. It's not in there. It disappeared. I'll read it to you. James chapter 5, verse 13. Remember what it says there about those who are sorrowful and those who are rejoicing? In James chapter 5, look at this. Look at the pronouns. In James chapter 5 and in verse 13, is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing psalms. You know what a psalm is? The definition of a psalm is a praise to God. Now, the psalms have other content in them, but just like the psalm we read this morning, the Psalms are mostly about expressing praise to God. I mean, that's to psalm means to praise God, really, in a way. And it says, if anyone is cheerful, let him, anyone, let him sing psalm. When an individual person is moved by God's goodness or by God's blessings, and he wants to express his cheer and his joy, he sings a praise to God. Private expression. You see that? Worship is also shown to us, exemplified to us as a private expression. But it doesn't stop there. Worship is a way of life. Worship is private expression. But also worship is public expression. And just look with me in the New Testament at the Christians. Acts 2, verse 46. Speaking of those who first obeyed the gospel of Christ, so continuing daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to them, or to the church daily, those who were being saved. This is a group description. James 5, verse 13 is talking about an individual, right? Anyone is cheerful. Let him sing a psalm. But this is the group of Christians. The first Christians, they're in Jerusalem. And they met regularly and they associated and they had this fellowship. And together, what were they doing? They were praising God. Things heated up as far as the persecution. Peter and John are interrogated because of their healing of a man who was lame and preaching the gospel in the temple court. After they're harassed by the authorities, they're released. And look what happens. They go and they gather with the other believers. Being let go, they went to their own companions and reported all the chief priests and elders had said to them. So when they, the group of Christians, heard that, they raised their voice to God with one accord and said, Lord, you are God who made heaven and earth and the sea and all that's in them. Now what they're going to do here in this prayer is they're going to request God to give them strength and courage to keep preaching the name of Christ. But they open this prayer with what? Praise. A recognition of God being the great creator. They're putting their lives in His hands. They are doing this. It's group expression of worship. And there's more. Paul writes to the Corinthians. The Corinthians were gathering together, but they were corrupting their activities by the things that we're doing. And that's why he says, therefore, when you come together in one place, it's not to eat the Lord's Supper. They're supposed to be eating the Lord's Supper, but they had so corrupted it that it was not the Lord's Supper. And so he has to give them the teaching to correct them. But look at the context. They were gathering together. And later on, as he teaches them the proper focus of this gathering around the Lord's Supper, he says, for often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. That's an act of worship. You're proclaiming the death of Christ. And you're doing it until this life ends. Because it's the greatest thing ever. It's a proclamation of the great thing that the Lord has done for us by shedding His blood and offering up His body on the cross. And you do it together. There's the statement we read James 5 a while ago about the individual rejoicing and singing to God. Praise. Ephesians 5 tells us, speaking to one another in psalms, praise. Praise to God. In hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. That you are in a gathering. You speak to one another when you're with one another. And in that gathering, you're singing praises to God. In that gathering from your heart, you're singing to the Lord. There is both a edification action going on. You're teaching each other, but you're also expressing worship to God. That's why our songs. We either do one of two things in our songs. Sometimes at the same time in the same song. We're expressing praise to God, and sometimes we teach and encourage and edify and admonish each other in those songs about walking with the Lord and serving the Lord. Biblical worship is about the way you live every day. It's also about personally expressing your worship to God. And it's about gathering with God's people, other believers, other worshipers, and giving Him thanks and giving Him glory. You know, somebody has a big birthday party. Let's say they turn, 70 or 80 or something like that. Okay? and everybody wants to really make a big deal about this. So you have a group celebration, right? You know, Grandpa turns 80. You don't go to him one at a time. Let's have a party. That's part of the momentum and part of the atmosphere and part of the elevation and the honor of Grandpa is everybody gets together at one time and you do this. And people make great effort to do that. A couple has a 40th or a 50th anniversary. And people get together to honor them. Yeah, you can show respect to them individually, but we all understand the moment and the importance of gathering together and doing that. And there is something special about gathering and doing that that doesn't happen when it's done individually. From the beginning, this is what God's people do when they admire Him. This is what they do when they love Him. This is what they do when they want to praise Him. They get with other believers and they do it. From cover to cover, you see that. Why do these definitions, and especially these dimensions of worship, show us? First of all, that they're all indispensable. And they all need attention. It's not just a way of life. Somebody says, well, you know, I live a good life every day. That honor and pleases God. Yeah, it does. But it's not just about a way of life. God wants you to stop and express your worship to Him, privately and publicly. He wants you to live a moral life, a righteous life, a life of service, but that's not enough. And it's also not just about private worship. Some may think, well, public gatherings are optional. They're nice, but you know, I can do on my own whatever the group does. You're missing an important aspect of worship by failing to gather with other believers. It's God's will that you do that. It's God's command that you do that. His people all through the biblical record did that. And your worship, as important as the other dimensions are, your worship is incomplete if you neglect that. But it's not just about expressions of worship. It's not just about the words that roll off your tongue and certain acts you may participate in. Don't think you can worship on Sunday and just live any way Monday to Saturday and it doesn't matter. All through the week, we are to be in awe of God's majesty. Sundays are wonderful and great, and other times that we gather, they help us so much, but they're there to put a charge in every other day and to carry that charge with us. This is like an exit. And we get back on that freeway. Sorry for the metaphor. Traffic metaphors around here. But you know what I mean. You get back in the game and you take that energy with you that comes from those gatherings. But all through the week we're to be touched by His grace. And not only are we to have Him on our minds and His praise on our lips every day, every hour, but our behavior should reflect His glory. And think about this. What would expressions of worship, acts and words, what would they mean to God if our life doesn't honor Him? Well, we know. This is brought up all kinds of places in the prophets, including Isaiah 1. Consider this, either read or listen to this. In Isaiah chapter 1, as Isaiah is starting his written record here, and this is evidently an early message that he had for the people as the Spirit guides him. In Isaiah chapter 1, verses 10 to 7, watch how that they were expressing worship